you look at your streaming dashboard and the math just feels entirely broken. Like, we all know the drill, right?
The endless grind.
Exactly. You grind to get those numbers up on Spotify. You're chasing these massive, I don't know, million play milestones, but chasing pennies on a streaming platform is, well, it's the slowest possible lane for making a living from music today.
It really is. It's brutal.
Right. So let's frame the reality of the industry for a second here. Landing just one mid-tier background track on, say, a TV commercial, that equals the total earnings of roughly 2 million Spotify streams.
Which is wild when you think about it. I mean, 2 million streams is a monumental task. It relies so heavily on, algorithmic luck.
And playlists?
Right, playlist placements you can't even control, and years of building an audience. But securing a single commercial placement, that operates on an entirely different and honestly highly systematic business model. If you understand the plumbing of how music actually gets licensed for media, the barrier to entry is surprisingly manageable.
And that actually brings us to our mission for this deep dive. Today, we're looking at a highly detailed guide from popularatools.ai, and it's focused specifically on taking AI-generated music and turning it into recurring, compounding sync licensing royalties.
Such an important topic right now.
It is. Because if you're sitting there listening to this with a hard drive full of incredible tracks you've generated using Suno or Udio over the weekend, the temptation is to just dump them all onto a streaming service,
Right,
right?
yeah, everyone does it.
But throwing it on Spotify is basically like buying a single apple. Today, we're talking about planting an apple tree that drops fruit for, the next 10 years.
I love that analogy. And to understand how we get to that orchard, we really have to look at why sync licensing pays out the way it does.
Right, let's get into the mechanics of it.
So the fundamental mechanism here is what the industry calls the two-paycheck system. Because sync licensing, at its core, is just the legal permission to synchronize a piece of audio with visual media.
So we're talking about like the tense, thumping bass line under a Netflix thriller, or the acoustic guitar in a dog food commercial.
Exactly. Or the background music in a video game loading screen. When you secure one of those placements, you don't just, sell the track for a flat rate and walk away.
Right, you get two paychecks.
Two paychecks. The first one you receive is the upfront sync fee. This is a lump sum paid by the production company or the ad agency simply for the right to drop your audio file into their video timeline.
And that happens pretty fast, right?
Yeah, that money hits your bank account before the commercial ever even airs.
Okay, and just to give some context, the source material puts that upfront fee anywhere from $1,500 to $5,000 just for a standard regional TV spot.
Which is great money, but that upfront money is honestly just the appetizer.
Right.
The second paycheck is the back-end performance royalty. Every single time that commercial airs on broadcast television or cable or qualifying streaming platforms, money is generated.
And this is where the PROs come in.
Exactly. This is tracked and collected by a performing rights organization, or PRO. In the US, that's ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC. In the UK, it's the PRS.
And what are they actually doing? Just watching TV?
Kind of. They monitor global broadcasts, collect the fractions of pennies for every single airing, bundle them all up, and then pay you out quarterly.
Okay, let's pause on that mechanism for a second, though, because I
Yeah.
think a lot of people wonder this. How does a PRO actually know that your specific AI-generated acoustic track played at like 2:00 a.m. on a local TV station in Ohio?
It's a fair question. It relies on a system of cue sheets and audio watermarking. So when a production company finishes a commercial, they are legally required to submit a cue sheet to the networks and the PROs.
Okay, like a master list.
Right. It lists every piece of music used, the exact time codes of when it plays, and who owns the rights. Simultaneously, modern broadcast networks use automated audio recognition technology.
Like Shazam.
Yeah, think of it like an industrial scale version of Shazam. It constantly listens to the broadcast feed and matches the audio fingerprint against the PRO's database. When a match hits, a royalty is tallied.
Wow. So over the lifespan of, say, a 5-year ad run, that initial $1,500 upfront placement might quietly generate an additional $2,500 to $10,000 in those back-end royalties.
Easily.
So one single placement suddenly becomes a $15,000 asset.
Yeah.
But hear the detail from the source that just completely changes the game for me. The vast majority of these sync deals are non-exclusive.
Yes. This is massive. Non-exclusive means you are only renting out the track for that specific commercial.
You still own it.
You completely own the underlying copyright. You can license that exact same song to the car commercial while simultaneously licensing it to a YouTube creator while having it sit in 5 different sync libraries waiting for more buyers.
And yes, you can still have it streaming on Spotify.
Exactly. Which really highlights the absurdity of the streaming model, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. Like we said, 1 million Spotify streams pays out maybe $3,500 to $4,000.
Yeah.
And then next month, the counter just resets to zero. You have to keep feeding the algorithm.
But in sync, the income layers upon itself because of those back-end royalties.
What do you mean by layers?
Let's say you hustle and land 3 placements in your first year. You get the upfront fees and the royalty clock starts ticking. Then in year 2, you land 8 new placements.
Okay.
You collect the upfront fees for those 8, but you are simultaneously receiving the back-end PRO checks from the 3 placements you secured the year prior. Your effort basically compounds.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. I really do.
Go for it.
If the math is this lucrative and the deals are non-exclusive, and literally anyone with an internet connection can go to Suno or Udio and prompt a brilliant studio-quality track in 2 minutes, why isn't the entire sync industry completely flooded by AI creators cashing these massive checks right now?
Well, the funny thing is, the industry was briefly flooded.
Oh, real?
Yeah. And the immediate response from professional sync libraries and music supervisors was to build a massive, highly sophisticated wall.
Of course.
They implemented extremely aggressive AI detection filters throughout 2025 and 2026 because the volume of submissions was literally paralyzing their human review teams. So they automated the rejection process.
So we aren't dealing with a human A&R rep deciding they, you know, don't like the vibe of your song. Mm. We're dealing with software bouncers guarding the door.
Software bouncers is the perfect way to put it. And these bouncers operate on 3 distinct layers of detection.
Okay, let's break those down.
The first layer is Synthide. This is a technology developed by Google DeepMind. It embeds an inaudible digital watermark directly into the audio waveform as the track is being generated by models like Suno and Udio.
Wait, so I can't hear it at all?
You cannot hear it, no, but a scanning algorithm spots it instantly.
Man, so it's the literal barcode baked into the sound waves.
Exactly. Then layer 2 is platform-specific spectral analysis.
Which means what exactly?
Well, when transformer-based AI models synthesize audio, they don't create sound the way a physical guitar string vibrates. They construct the audio statistically.
Okay.
And this process leaves behind microscopic artifacts. Think of them like the distinct brush strokes of a specific painter, and these are visible only in the audio spectrum. Libraries constantly update their software to recognize the brushstrokes of the latest AI models.
Wow. Not messing around. And what's layer 3?
C2PA metadata tagging. This is the Content Authenticity Initiative standard. It is basically cryptographic data written into the actual file header of your MP3 or WAV.
So it's right in the file data.
Yeah. It explicitly flags the file's origin as artificial intelligence. So if a music supervisor's inbox receives a file with a C2PA tag, the email software often automatically routes it to the trash before anyone even clicks play.
That is so frustrating. It's like writing a brilliant, commercially viable novel, but mailing it to the publisher on a specific brand of paper that triggers their automated shredder.
That's exactly what it's like. The music could be the perfect fit for a Honda commercial, but it is shadow banned entirely just because of the file's origin.
So I guess the reality is that raw AI generation is completely insufficient for the professional market.
Completely. Submitting raw tracks is the fastest way to get permanently blacklisted by these libraries. You have to process the audio to get past the automated shredders so your track can actually receive a fair human evaluation based on its sonic merits.
And the source guide points to a very specific bottleneck tool for this, right? Undetector.
Yes, Undetector.
It's like a 39-euro lifetime software designed entirely to format these files for professional submission. How does it actually work?
It acts as a comprehensive audio sanitizer. You run your track through Undetector, and it algorithmically smooths out the spectral fingerprints, it strips out the inaudible Synthied watermark, and it completely scrubs the C2PA metadata from the file header.
So it basically rewrites the paper so the fretter doesn't catch it.
Precisely. It reconstructs the waveform just enough to bypass the automated detection without degrading the broadcast quality of the music itself.
Okay, so assuming we have used our tool, we have a clean, undetectable, high-quality track. Where does it actually go? Because honestly, staring at a list of sync companies is overwhelming. and throwing everything at the biggest names right away seems like a recipe for getting ignored.
It absolutely is. You have to treat the sync library landscape like building financial credit.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. You cannot walk into a major bank and ask for a $1 million mortgage if you have zero credit history. You have to start with a starter credit card, build a paper trail of reliability, and level up.
Okay, let's map that out for the listener.
Right.
What is the starter credit card of the sync world?
Pond5. It is the ultimate starting point for a newcomer. Pond5 operates on an open marketplace model. Their submissions are open, their policies are highly permissive toward AI-assisted creators, and crucially, you set your own prices.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you retain 35 to 60% of the sale. It's a volume game, honestly. But getting your first dozen tracks accepted there proves to yourself that your workflow is viable.
It's proof of concept. So once you have that foundation on Pond5, where do you take your credit score next?
You move up to the mid-tier subscription models. So that's places like Artlist and Soundstripe.
What's the difference there?
These platforms cater heavily to digital creators, YouTubers, and mid-level corporate brands. Artlist pays out from a massive royalty share pool based on how often your tracks are downloaded by their subscribers.
Got it.
They are known to be quite pragmatic. If the track sounds great and solves a problem for their users, they're open to it.
Mm-hmm.
Soundstripe is similar, offering really solid mid-tier curation. Then there's Songtrade, which is more of an aggregator model with global scale, though they have stricter rules.
But these are all essentially passive libraries, right?
Great.
You upload, add some tags, and wait for a video editor to stumble across your song. But the source highlights Music Gateway as a totally different beast.
Yeah, Music Gateway is where things get exciting. It shifts you from passive waiting to active pitching. It revolves around a brief system.
A brief system?
Yes. Music supervisors actively post their immediate needs. So a brief might say, we are editing a 90-second trailer for a dark streaming thriller. We need a driving synthwave track at 120 beats per minute, heavily distorted bass, absolutely no vocals. Budget is $3,000 up front.
So instead of throwing your song into a massive search engine void, you are handing it directly to the person holding the checkbook.
Exactly. But you only pitch if you have the exact track they are looking for.
Right. No spamming.
Never spam. And once you master that brief system, you finally have the portfolio and the industry literacy to approach the VIP room.
The mortgage lender. MusicBed.
Okay. MusicBed curates for high-end ad agencies and professional filmmakers. They have incredibly strict submission standards. But because their barrier to entry is so high, the payouts and revenue shares are highly competitive.
So don't start there.
Do not submit to MusicBed until you have a proven catalog of successful, cleared placements from the lower tiers.
Okay, we know the financial stakes. We know the detection wall and the tool to tear it down. We know the landscape of the libraries. But reading about the tools isn't the same as actually doing the job.
Right.
If I am sitting at my computer today, what is the exact step-by-step life cycle of a single track?
Mm-hmm.
Like from a blank screen to a royalty check.
All right, let's walk through the 7 steps. The life cycle begins with step 1, the generation phase. But you have to use the right tool for the right objective. You are primarily using Suno or Udio.
And they have different strengths, right?
Very different. Suno is highly adept at understanding overall song structure, you know, the verse, chorus, bridge progression, and delivering high production polish. Udio, on the other hand, is currently superior at generating distinct, emotionally resonant vocal performances.
But regardless of the tool, there is a massive technical hurdle here that I think AI creators completely misunderstand. Suno spits out a flattened MP3 file. The bass, the drums, the vocals, they're all baked into one single audio cake.
That is a critical point.
Because if you send that flat file to a music supervisor, it is entirely useless to them.
Imagine a video editor cutting a car commercial. They have your track playing, and suddenly the voiceover announcer needs to say 0% APR financing. If your AI vocalist is singing over the announcer, the frequencies clash, the dialogue is buried, and the editor will just delete your track and find another one.
Right. So how do you fix a baked cake?
Step 2. You have to separate the ingredients before you do anything else. You take that raw generative output and run it through an AI stem splitter.
Okay.
This software isolates the frequencies and gives you separate file stems for the vocals, the drums, the bass, and the other instruments. You must be able to provide instrumental-only versions or vocal-only a cappellas to give the editor complete control.
Got it. And once you have those separated stems,
you move into the digital audio workstation, your DAW. This is where you actually master the track for broadcast. You are applying EQ to clean up the muddy frequencies AI often produces, adding compression, and using a limiter to ensure the overall loudness hits roughly -14 LUFS.
-14 LUFS. Why that specific number?
It's the broadcast standard. It ensures your track isn't jarringly louder or quieter than the dialogue it will sit underneath. And when you export from the DAW, it must be a YUV or an AIFF file. High resolution, uncompressed audio.
No MP3s.
If a supervisor downloads an MP3, it screams amateur, and it will often be rejected on format alone.
Okay, so step three. We have our mastered uncompressed WAV file. Now we can run it through the cleanup phase we discussed earlier.
Exactly. We drop it into Undetector, strip the synthid, scrub the C2PA metadata, and smooth the spectral fingerprints. We now have a broadcast-ready, undetectable asset.
So what's step four?
This is where the business mechanics take over. Before you upload that track anywhere, you must secure your publishing rights. This means acquiring an ISRC code.
An ISRC code. Break that down for us.
The International Standard Recording Code. Think of it as the digital license plate for your specific audio recording. It is a unique 12-character alphanumeric code that tracks that exact file across the globe. You generate these codes through your national PRO or through distribution platforms.
Okay.
Once you have the ISRC, you register the track with your PRO ASCAP BMI PRS.
Now, the source guide is absolutely militant about the timing of this. It says you must register the track with your PRO before you upload it to any sync library. Why does the sequence matter so much?
Because the bureaucracy of global royalty collection is incredibly slow. A PRO registration can take several weeks to fully process in their database.
So you jump the gun.
Right. If you submit an unregistered track to Music Gateway, a supervisor loves it, buys it, and it airs on television 3 days later, your track doesn't exist in the PRO system yet. The automated listening software on the broadcast network won't find a match.
Oh, man.
That back-end royalty money evaporates. You cannot retroactively claim a broadcast that wasn't in the system when it aired.
Wow. Okay. Register first. Understood. So the track is registered. We have our digital license plate. Now, step five, we hit the upload phase.
Yes.
Since we are operating non-exclusively, we upload the clean WAV file to Pond5, Artlist, and Soundstripe simultaneously. But uploading isn't just dragging and dropping a file, is it?
Not at all. Uploading is entirely an exercise in metadata. If you title your track Chill Vibes 4 or Upbeat Corporate Track, you are making yourself functionally invisible.
Because they aren't searching for that.
Music supervisors search massive databases using highly specific emotive and technical keywords. They aren't typing good song.
Right. They're typing suspenseful driving bass, 120 BPF, dark electronic, no vocals.
Precisely. Your metadata needs to read like a technical manual for the emotion of the song. You tag the exact tempo, the primary instruments, the mood, the genre, and sounds like references. The metadata is the only bridge between a supervisor's search bar and your audio file.
So that's step five. Step six is pitching directly to Active Briefs on Music Gateway, which we covered. And the final step, step seven, the guide outlines, is tracking, building a master spreadsheet.
Crucial.
You log the track title, the ISRC code, the PRO registration number, the date submitted to Pond5, the date pitched to a brief on Music Gateway, and any placement confirmations. But wait, I have to stop here because looking at the reality of this tracking system, the source mentions that PRO royalty statements can be delayed 6 to 18 months after a placement actually airs on television.
That is correct.
If I land a car commercial today, I might not see the back-end money until almost 2 years from now. How do these organizations justify that kind of lag in the digital age?
They justify it through the sheer friction of global bureaucracy. It is a harsh reality. When your track plays in Germany, the German network has to log the cue sheet, report it to the German PRO, who then audits the data, bundles the funds, takes their administrative cut, and transfers it to your American PRO, like BMI.
Religious.
And then BMI audits the data again before adding it to your quarterly statement.
It's an agonizingly slow burn.
It really is, which is why the tracking spreadsheet is the definitive line dividing the amateurs from the professionals. If you know a regional ad ran for 6 months, and 18 months later you haven't seen a statement from ASCAP, your spreadsheet gives you the exact ISRC code and broadcast dates to file a missing royalty claim.
So if you aren't tracking your assets, that money simply falls through the cracks of the system and stays in the PRO's bank account.
Exactly.
Okay, let's ground all of this heavy machinery in reality.
All right.
If a listener commits to this, they split the stems, master the audio, clean it with Undetector, register the ISRCs, and diligently tag their metadata, what does actual success look like financially?
It requires managing expectations first. You are not going to land a $250,000 global placement in the next James Bond film out of the gate.
Right, keep it realistic.
You are aiming for the middle class of the sync industry. Regional television commercials, background music for reality TV, YouTube sponsorships, and corporate training videos.
And the guide models a conservative projection based on building a solid 50-track catalog. In year one, if you land just 2 to 3 mid-tier placements, you are pulling in roughly $3,000 to $4,500.
Mm-hmm.
And that is almost entirely upfront sync fees because, as we establish, your back-end royalties are trapped in that 18-month bureaucratic delay.
But look at year two. You expand your pitching and you hit 5 to 8 placements. Now you are looking at $10,000 to $16,000.
Wow.
Not just because you landed more upfront fees, but because year one's back-end royalties are finally arriving in your mailbox.
And year three is where the math of layering truly flexes. Assuming 10 to 15 placements across a maturing catalog, the projection puts you at $20,000 to $50,000 annually.
Right.
You are collecting year three's upfront fees, plus year one's ongoing long-tail royalties, plus year two's new royalties.
But to achieve that compounding effect, you have to survive the fatal mistakes that kill most AI catalogs early. We covered submitting raw, uncleaned AI signatures. We covered the fatal error of uploading MP3s instead of WAVs.
And the generic, invisible metadata titles.
Yeah. There is also the mistake of tone mismatch. If a music supervisor is sourcing for a detergent commercial, they want clean, emotionally obvious commercial music. If you submit a 10-minute experimental ambient noise track generated on a whim, you are demonstrating that you don't understand their client base.
The generative AI tools are so staggeringly powerful now that they completely handle the musical execution. Your job is no longer just writing the song. Your job is the business execution, formatting, cleaning, tagging, and pitching.
Precisely.
And honestly, if you look at this ecosystem as a whole, a 50-track catalog making $50,000 a year in sync is incredible. But because these are non-exclusive agreements, those exact same 50 tracks are also earning money on Spotify, they are generating YouTube content ID revenue, and they're available for purchase on Bandcamp.
It's amazing.
Sync licensing is just the heaviest, most lucrative layer of a multi-stream machine.
Generating the music is frankly only 10% of the job. The real money is entirely in the business mechanics. If you treat your AI output like a professional, manageable asset rather than a disposable digital toy, the financial ceiling completely changes.
So if you are reading popularatools.ai and you already have that hard drive full of great generative audio, you're sitting on prime, undeveloped real estate. You already own the land. You just have to do the bureaucratic work to build the houses.
I want to leave you with a final concept to mull over regarding the nature of this industry.
Go for it.
Think about the future definition of passive income. If an AI track takes you maybe 2 hours to generate, split the stems, master, clean with undetector, register, and upload today, but that track continues to be discovered and pays out compounding PRO royalties for the next 10 years, how will this completely reshape the global music economy as AI generation gets even faster?
It's a staggering shift in leverage, honestly. The tools are right in front of you. It's time to stop chasing pennies on streaming and start planting those apple trees. Get your audio cleaned, get your ISRCs registered, and start building your catalog. We will catch you on the next deep dive.